Please God, Marty whispered to herself, don't let it be the one about the Englishman and the Scotsman and the American in the railway carriage, nor the one about the old lady and the parrot, nor the one about the couple arriving at the seaside hotel on their honeymoon night. I'll settle for any of the others, but please, please be merciful, God. Not one of those three. I can't bear it. I shall do something awful. I'll shriek. I'll make a hideous scene. I'll bash his head in with a bottle. Her husband, sitting opposite to her at the table, cleared his throat. Her whole body became rigid at the sound. With a great effort, she took a cigarette out of a little blue enamel pot in front of her and lit it. Some of the general conversation at the table died away into polite attentiveness. She was aware, wretchedly aware, of the quick, resigned glance that Louis Bennett exchanged with Susan Lake. She looked at her host, Carol Davis, leaning forward politely, his good-looking face blank. Carol was kind. Carol understood. His manners were dictated by his heart. He wouldn't hurt Budge's feelings for the world. He would listen appreciatively and laugh at the right moments, saving his loudest, most convincing laugh for the point at the end, and Budge would never know, never remotely suspect for an instant that he hadn't been amused. In the old days, he used to be funny on the stage, but now he'd even lost that. Marty drew deeply at her cigarette. Jane and Shirley and Bobby Peake were still talking and laughing at the other end of the table. Budge shot them a quick, resentful look and cleared his throat again. They glanced up and the light went out of their faces. Shirley stubbed out her cigarette, put her head back and closed her eyes. Marty felt an insane desire to lean forward and slap her face violently. Listen, you languid, supercilious bitch. Budge Ripley's going to tell a story. Sit up and listen and mind your manners. He was telling stories, amusing people, millions of people, making them forget their troubles, making them happy before you were born. Stop me if you've heard it. Budge's voice grated in the silence. He caught her eye, and painting an encouraging smile on her face, she leaned forward. No more than a split second could have passed before he began, but in that split second, the years of her life with him rolled out before her. She'd been getting on quite well 20 years ago when she'd first met him, chorus and understudy and small parts here and there. She'd never been pretty, but there was something about her that people liked, a comic quality of personality. Carol had always asked her to his grandest parties. It was at one of these, in this same house, that Budge had first noticed her. It was in this same house 3 years later, after she'd slept with him hundreds of times, that he told her that his divorce was through and that they could get married. 17 years ago, that was. They'd moved into number 18. She'd been so proud, so grateful, and he'd been so sweet. No more stage work for her, no more prancing on and off for finales and opening choruses. She ran the house fairly well, went to all Budge's first nights in a box or stalls, stood with him afterwards in the dressing room while people came rushing in to say how marvellous he was. Funnier than ever. I laughed until I was sick. Nobody like you, Budge, the comic genius of the age. Several years of happiness passed. Several years of excitement and success and occasional holidays in the south of France. Then, insidiously, the rot began to set in. Very gradually at first. He began to be unfaithful to her. Nothing serious. Just an occasional roll in the hay with someone who took his fancy. Marty found out about this almost immediately, and it hurt her immeasurably. She reasoned with herself, of course. She exerted every ounce of common sense and self-control, and succeeded bleakly in so far that she said nothing and did nothing. But from then on, everything was different. There was no security anymore, and no peace of mind. It wasn't that she cared so desperately about his popping into bed every now and then with someone else. It was something deeper. Something that bewildered and gnawed at her. Something more important, that she knew to exist but somehow couldn't identify. It was quite a while later that the truth suddenly became clear to her, that the answer to this riddle that had tortured her for so long suddenly flashed onto her consciousness. Budge was jealous of her. He was jealous of her wit, her gaiety, her friends. She could have slept with other men as much as she liked, and he would have forgiven her. She could have drunk herself into a coma every night, and he would have been loving and concerned and understanding. But because she was herself, because people of all kinds found her good company, because she could, without effort, embroider an ordinary anecdote with genuine humour and infectious gaiety, and be loved and welcomed for it, this he could never forgive. This, she realized in that blinding flash of revelation, he would hate her for until the day he died. Stop me if you've heard it. That idiotic, insincere phrase, as though people ever had the courage to stop anyone, however many times they'd heard it. Human beings could be incredibly brave about many things. They could fly in jet-propelled planes, fling themselves from the sky in parachutes, crawl on their mortal stomachs through bullet-spattered mud, and take pins out of unexploded bombs or shells or whatever they were. But no one in the whole twisting, agonized world was brave enough to say loudly and clearly, "Yes, I have heard it. It's dull and unfunny. It bores the liver and lights out of me. I have heard it over and over again, and if I have to hear it once more in any of the years that lie between me and the grave, I'll plunge a fork into your silly throat. I'll pull out your clacking tongue with my nails." Marty suddenly caught sight of her hands. One was resting on the table. The other was holding her cigarette. Both were trembling. She looked miserably round the table. They were all listening with exaggerated courtesy. Budge's voice grated on. The Englishman, the Scotsman, and the American. "I say, you know. Och, aye. Gee." Marty stared across the years at his face. There it was, aged a little but not much changed since she'd loved it so. The same kindly, rather protuberant blue eyes, the straw-coloured hair, the fleshy nose, the wide comedian's mouth. His head was bent forward eagerly. He was talking a trifle too quickly because somewhere, writhing deep inside him, was a suspicion that his audience wasn't wholly with him. He hadn't quite got them. He finished the Scotsman's bit. Bobby Peake laughed. Marty could have flung her arms round his neck and hugged him for it. Budge's eyes shone with pleasure. "Gee, buddy." There was quite a loud laugh at the end of the story. Carol's kindness triumphed over his wisdom. "That was wonderful, Budge," he said. "Nobody can tell a story like you." Marty's heart died in her. She made a swift, instinctive movement to get up from the table. Budge looked at her, and his eyes hardened. She sat still as death, chained to her chair. He cleared his throat again. "Marty, half getting up like that reminded me of a good one," he said. "Do you know the one about the shy lady at the dinner party who wanted to go to the telephone?" There was a polite murmur round the table. Shirley took her compact out of her bag and scrutinized her face in the little mirror. Louis Bennett coughed and exchanged another meaningful glance with Susan. Budge pushed back his chair, recrossed his legs, and started. Marty stared down into her lap. There was some gold embroidery on her dress, and it seemed to be expanding and changing into curious shapes, because her eyes were filled with tears. 100 years later, they were driving home. It was very late, and the streets were almost empty. Budge was bunched up in his corner, sulky and silent. They arrived at number 18, still in silence. Rose had left the drink tray on the dining room table and a plate of curly-looking sandwiches. Budge poured himself out a whiskey and soda. "I'm going on up," he said. "I'm tired." Suddenly, something seemed to crack inside Marty's head, and she started to laugh. There was an ugly note in it which she recognized, but she had neither the strength nor the will to do anything about it. "You must be," she said. "Oh, my God, you certainly must be." Budge stopped at the door and turned and looked at her. "What exactly do you mean by that?" he said. "Don't you really know? Haven't you got the faintest idea?" Budgie's already red face flushed, and he advanced two steps towards her. "What's the matter with you?" Marty backed away from him, still laughing miserably. "This is a good one," she said. "Stop me if you've heard it. Stop me if you've heard it or not, because if you don't, you'll never forgive me, and I shall never forgive myself." Budge frowned. "Are you drunk?" Marty shook her head dumbly. She felt the tears starting and tried to wipe them away with the back of her hand. Budge came closer to her and looked carefully into her face. There was no more anger in his eyes, only bewilderment. She tried to look away, to escape from that puzzled, anxious face. She backed further, and feeling the edge of a chair under her knees, sank down into it. "What's the matter?" Budge persisted. "You're not ill or anything, are you? Is it anything to do with me? What have I done?" He put his hand on her arm. She felt the warmth of it passing through her sleeve. Suddenly, her hysteria evaporated. She felt utterly exhausted, but no longer wild, no longer shrill and nerve-strained and cruel. She put her hand up and pressed his more firmly onto her arm. And then she gave a little giggle, and not a very convincing one, really, but good enough. "You may well ask what you've done," she said. "You may well ask if it's anything to do with you." Her voice broke, and bringing her face against his stomach, she started crying, thoroughly and satisfyingly. Budge remained silent, but his other hand smoothed her hair away from her forehead. After a moment or two, she controlled herself a bit and pushed him gently away. "You've given me a miserable evening," she said huskily. "You never took your eyes off Shirley Dale from the beginning of supper to the end. You then behaved like a sulky little boy all the way home in the car, and to round the whole thing off, you help yourself to a drink without even asking if I want one, and tell me you're tired. You're an inconsiderate, lecherous little pig, and I can't imagine why I ever let you lead me to the register office." She rose to her feet and put her arms round him tightly. She felt his body relax. He gave a complacent chuckle. "Of all the bloody fools," he said, and the warmth was back in his voice. The crisis had passed, and the truth was stamped down again deep into the ground. He led her over to the table and mixed her a drink. "Shirley Dale, indeed. You must be out of your mind." She stood there with one arm still round him, sipping her drink. Nothing more was said until he'd switched off the lights and they'd gone upstairs. They talked ordinarily while they undressed. The familiarity of the bedroom seemed over-eager to put their hearts at ease. Later on, when he'd attacked his teeth in the bathroom as though they were personal enemies, sprinkled himself with Floris 127, and put on his pyjamas, he came over and sat on the edge of her bed. She smiled and reached out and patted his hand. Then gently, almost timidly, as though she wasn't quite sure of her ground, she pulled him towards her. "I've got something to tell you," she said. "Stop me if you've heard it."